you know, they couldn't do that. They couldn't just perform in this nice, neat little box with their blocking and being in just the right place, and you know, the director being in lockstep with them. They couldn't even do that because that too was a part of their art.
Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records. Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track by track breakdown of all the songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety.
Hello, hello. What's up, everyone? Welcome to Talking Records, an album spotlight podcast where we take an album and round up all the information we possibly can and put it all here. I'm just a huge fan of music, and learning about the events and conditions under which my favorite albums were made enhances my enjoyment of the album so much. So, I invite friends to join me in diving into the album, digging through the tracks, and talking about how we got into the records, and I'm pumped to be joined once again by my friend Adam Taylor.
Hey, Jed! I'm so happy to be back and talking about one of my favorite Who records of all time, Quadrophenia. Oh, wait.
Needle scratch.
Wrong episode. It's big stuff, Tim.
Yes. I am really excited to talk about this album today, Adam, because I feel like there's so much to talk about.
Yeah, I got a lot to say, and I think we kind of did the same notes on the book.
Ah, yes, you have trouble, boys. Excellent.
We probably have the same exact insights, so I'm going to try not to copycat you on our little factoids, but I'm not promising anything.
Well, it should be an enlightening episode then. Today, Adam and I will be talking about The Replacements' 1985 album, Tim. The Replacements released Tim on September 18th, 1985 on Sire Records. The album was recorded that summer at Nicolette Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The same studio, Adam, that Surfin' Bird was recorded in.
Ooh.
Little nugget for you. The album was produced by Tommy Ramone. This would be the band's major label debut. And the path to the majors for this band is absolutely fascinating.
Seymour Stein saw such a team in Paul Westerberg and Tommy Stinson that it was kind of this package deal.
Yeah. So the band's first two records were loud. I mean, they were punk records. And then the band really came into their own on the third record, Let It Be. So that's like a major fan favorite. People love that album. You know, it kind of blended the musical styles that, you know, Paul Westerberg really seemed to be enjoying at that time, sort of was experimenting with some slower stuff, some softer stuff. And I feel like it's a good lead-in into this record.
I think Let It Be encapsulates what was so great about the Twin Tone era. And it was a good segue, a good foreshadowing, if you will, into the records that they were going to be putting out on the major label when they signed to Warner. But, you know, it had some fantastic songs like Answering Machine that they almost ended up playing on Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. But at that point, they were already signed to Warner. And Warner thought, well, why are you going to perform a song from Twin Tone Records when you're promoting an album on Warner Brothers?
Right.
So they decided to axe that and to do Bastards of Young and Kiss Me on the Bus.
I'm glad you brought that up because the band definitely did not take themselves seriously. I mean, well, they did, but they were like blowing off concerts. They would drink too much. They didn't even bother to really promote their own music. I mean, it was just like wild. Warner Brothers A&R man Michael Hill had been trying to sign the band for a while but couldn't convince his bosses to do it. As the band's album Let It Be began building a name for itself, you know, suddenly all these labels were turning their attention to the band. And you'd think that like the band would like, you know, sort of, you know, step up and be like, okay, we've got labels courting us now. It's time to get our act together. But that is the opposite of what they did.
They doubled down with their partying. Oh yeah. When they knew that they were being shopped around by the major labels, they're like, no, let's be the most replacements we can absolutely be. And I think it was Paul Westerberg that said, if we can't potentially have fun on stage for an hour during the day, we're going to make sure that we have as much fun as we can the other 23 hours of the day. And they were true to form. Oh yes.
Absolutely. Despite that, they were interested in majors. I guess with Twin Tone, they weren't getting royalties, is what I read.
If you say so, I'm not sure exactly, but no. I can understand that an independent label wouldn't have the deep pockets the way that Sire and Warner Brothers would have. So I wouldn't be surprised.
So talking more about some of those live shows, there was one particular infamous CBGB show where the band basically got up on stage in front of all these music industry people and played like 44 snippets of cover songs ranging from Iron Man to U2's I Will Follow, like changing all the song titles and just being crazy.
And I think that's what they were mainly known for. I think people needed to be primed before they saw the Replacements back in the 80s, because I don't think they knew exactly what they were getting into. And, this devil may care attitude on stage, I think just lent to the most fun the crowd or the band could ever have, as long as you knew what to expect. And, you know, them playing 45, 50 some odd snippets of covers, I wish I could say that was a one-time thing, but you know, there was a bootleg, The Shit Hits the Fans, and it was not CB's, it was another city. And that's something they got very famous for doing, for getting up there and getting pissed drunk and not playing any of the hits, and sometimes not even playing any originals at all.
Can you imagine that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess you just have to roll with it, and you have to go with an open mind and maybe be a little bit loosened up yourself to fully appreciate what was going on. And I think they were and will be ahead of their time. And there's a lot of copycat bands. They wish they could be as cool.
Yeah.
They can't quite pull it off though.
Michael Hill was able to convince Warner Brothers vice president and Sire Records co-founder Seymour Stein to sign the band after an inebriated Stein caught the band live at Irving Plaza and loved what he heard. So despite the fact that they were up there doing, you know, terrible one night, I guess they had a really on night or something, and Seymour Stein just happened to catch him. The band was unpredictable, and getting them into the studio fast seemed like a really good idea.
Yeah, and I believe at this time they were courted by, amongst other people, Alex Chilton of Big Star,
who
I'm sure will come up quite a few more times in the podcast. And he ended up, you know, also being a huge fan. He was playing CBs at the time as a solo artist post Big Star, ended up doing some demos for the Tim record, but didn't make the final cut in terms of producers. As we all know, that went to Tommy or Delhi, or however you pronounce Tommy Ramone's
Herday
last name.
Well, you know, I think Alex Chilton was in the crowd that night for that CBGBs. I think he was like one of the few people that was like, yes, this is wonderful. This is genius, you know? So
I can almost guarantee that he was there that night. Yeah. Just reveling in it and said, oh, I need to be as close to this band as possible. And, you know, one album later, I mean, we can save this for the Please to Meet Me episode. But one of the Replacements' biggest songs is called Alex Chilton as a tribute to the man himself.
That's funny. He was their first choice as producer. And yeah, you're right. They did some demos with him. I guess one of the songs on the record actually is from that session.
Left of the Dial.
Yeah. So they kept that one.
Right. Yeah. That was the, I think, only track on Tim that was recorded by Alex Chilton during the demo sessions. And I guess they liked it enough that they said, well, we'll keep it. And I guess if you have the big expanded, you know, box sets or anything like that, I'm sure you can find the one that Tommy Ramone recorded. But no, the demo one's the one that made it to the record.
Yeah, which is cool. And you know what? I kind of wish, and we'll talk more about this when we get into the songs, but I kind of wish they had kept the demo version of Kiss Me on the Bus. It's a thrashier, heavier version. When they did it with Alex Chilton on the Tim, as you know, it's kind of a more, you know, lighter song.
I love the demo of that. It doesn't quite have that sheen to it, that that Big Star influenced version of Kiss Me on the Bus that made it. Yeah, I love hearing all those alternate versions, and sometimes it's fun to compile them and make an alternate album with just outtakes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Vibes, different mojo work in. And
I hear you, man. I do that stuff all the time. Also, it's interesting to note that the song Can't Hardly Wait was attempted during these sessions, but abandoned. I guess they weren't feeling it at that time, or they felt like it needed more, or just wasn't ready. Huge song for them, but almost went on Tim.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know if they always had planned on putting it off till the next record. That has to be their biggest track. Covered a ton, you know, in a lot of soundtracks. The Can't Hardly Wait soundtrack, they named the damn movie after that song. And yeah, what a movie that is. But that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty cool that they left a song as amazing as Can't Hardly Wait off, considering that Paul Westerberg wrote a number of the tracks like in just weeks.
Yeah.
Weeks preceding to the studio.
Right. Days.
Yeah, if that's not a songwriter at the apex of their career, I don't know what is. When you can just hammer out all of these amazing songs, and I'm not saying all of them were written so hastily, but any one single song, I know Hold My Life that opens the record is one of them. To say that you would record or that you would write a song that amazing just weeks before going in, they must have just had an overabundance of good stuff.
Yeah. So all the songwriting, the softer stuff that Paul was writing did not sit well with guitarist Bob Stinson. Stinson was struggling with drugs and, you know, mental health, and was absent for most of the recording. Tim features songs that seem to only be on the album to give Bob something to do.
Yeah, Bob was struggling with mental health. He had a, you know, new bunch of friends he was hanging out with, and he was really struggling. And essentially, although Bob Stinson was credited on the record, it was kind of his farewell record. And I guess quite a few of the leads were, you know, recorded by Paul, maybe even Tommy recorded some of those leads. And people would often ask Bob Stinson, how's the recording going? You got this new major label album that you're recording for. And he'd say, how the fuck should I know? I'm not in any of the sessions. I read in Trouble Boys that he kept his job as a cook.
Yeah.
During the recording. Yeah, I mean, I think he just kind of was done with the band, and it said that he would have just been happy playing the dive bars around the Twin Cities. Yeah. And, you know, didn't want to be this big rock and roll star and have national attention. And he was just fine keeping his job as a cook at a restaurant, mm-hmm. and playing at the local dive bars, and wasn't really interested in the newfound success of the band.
Understandable. Understandable. They started off as one thing and they kind of gradually changed to something else. He was probably like, hey, what happened to the, you know, what happened to the place where we started?
Yeah, I'm sure he was happy as a pig in shit about, you know, the Sorry Ma material and the Hootenanny material, mm-hmm. and didn't want to progress further than that. And that's his journey. And rest in peace, Bob Stinson.
Yeah. According to Tommy Ramone in Tape Op magazine, talking about Bob, he was like a man possessed. He would get these cascades of sound coming out of his instrument and amp. He was a natural player who played totally out of his head. We recorded everything he played and used his parts where they fit well. In addition to producing the music, Tommy had another job. In Tape Op, he explains, one of my priorities was keeping the band sober. Tim has to be their most sober album. They helped give them a new dimension. I got along well with them, including Bob. I'm good at working with people like that. I try to get into their world and try to snap them out of it a bit, bring them to a new reality where we combine their vision with mine. I've quite often worked with eccentric people. I seem to be able to have a rapport with them. So kind of a neat quote from Tommy Ramone, you know. He did, after all, have to work with Joey, Johnny, and Dee Dee.
That's true. That's true. Oh, yeah. and Phil Spector almost blew their damn brains out. Yeah. But that's not really so much to do with them as it had to do with him.
Yeah.
Whatever happened, you know, during that time recording, something special really happened. I mean, I go way back with this record. It's my favorite Replacements record. You know, I remember buying it at this record shop, Mystery Train Records in Amherst, Mass.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
22 years ago. It may have been the late 90s for all I know, when the vinyl prices weren't jacked up. I think I only paid 10 bucks for my copy. And I remember dubbing it on cassette and walking around high school with my dubbed cassette copy of it. And years later, you know, getting to meet Paul Westerberg and having him autograph my copy.
Wow.
And I remember, I mean, even the Bastards of Young music video, I think, is the first music video I ever remember seeing in my entire life. Sitting in an apartment in Boston when I was 2-3 years old. So all that stuff really dates me. From the dub cassette tape,
yeah,
to watching the Replacements on MTV. Yeah, I knew even when I was a baby, I remember seeing that Bastards of Young music video and thinking, I know what cool is. This is cool. This is rock and roll. And I love whatever this is. And I want more.
Right. You're probably like, what is this? And that's exciting, you know, and something is so strange. It's just a single shot of a speaker. And then a guy kicks the speaker in. And something about that, it was like really neat.
And I didn't even know how revolutionary it was at the time because I was a baby, but it was in black and white. It didn't mean anything to me. There was you couldn't see the front of the guy in the music video. You saw a speaker and a cigarette twirling in someone's fingers, and that's it. And I connected with it immediately, even as a baby. So good job, Ramon. Good job, Paul. Good job, Tommy, Chris, and a little bit of Bob on there.
So what about the music on this record, Adam, really kind of pulled you in?
Well, for me personally, there's a huge duality going on, isn't there? I mean, it's poignant. It's poetic. I mean, Paul Westerberg is a poet, a really good poet. And that is juxtaposed with just unbridled rock and roll.
Yeah.
It's got something for everyone. It's got a beat and you can dance to it. You know, I don't think it can be understated enough that, you know, Paul Westerberg is one of the most important American rock and roll songwriters of all time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got to hand it to him. I mean, he had so much talent and still has so much talent for writing music. And then on top of being able to write the amazing lyrics that are on this goddamn record. And really, you know, that just kicked off, actually with Let It Be, kicked off an amazing career. As I mean, Paul Westerberg could write a book of poetry and he could go down history as a poet if he didn't write a song in his whole life. So I don't know. There's a lot to say.
Yeah.
What struck you when you heard this? What are your first memories of hearing it, seeing anything related to it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I found the Replacements sometime during the 90s. I still am a huge alternative rock fan. I was, you know, getting into Nirvana and Pearl Jam and all these bands and, you know, just diving headfirst into this world of alternative rock. And, you know, I knew a lot about classic rock because I grew up in a household where my parents played a lot of classic rock. But it was actually a friend of mine who turned me on to the Replacements and told me I needed to hear this record. It was like one of those things where he's like, here, take this. This is what you need. This is like a primer for alternative rock. You know, if you're listening to all these bands, you better check out this band.
Awesome. It was Tim specifically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So the funny thing is though, Adam, he handed me this thing and I was like, oh, what a sucky title. So I actually didn't listen to it right away. I put it away. I kind of just put it somewhere and didn't go to it right away.
Who's Tim?
Yeah. So I was like, how could something called Tim be anything? You know, how could this be cool? But you know, when I finally threw it on, I was blown away by like the memorable and interesting songs like Hold My Life, Bastards, and Swinging Party. I loved that song. And I just remember listening to that over and over and over again and just being like really impressed that, you know, there was country tunes on there. There was rockers on there. There was lighter songs on there. I was like, these guys aren't afraid to just do whatever.
And they can do whatever, and they can get away with it. And some bands, you know, they can just write punk rock songs, or they can just do, you know, the little twangy alt rock thing, and that's their niche. And, yeah. and Replacements are too good to do that. They've got their hand in many different pots of genres, and I think that's one of the things that drew me, especially to that middle era when they first signed to Warner Brothers, because from Tim on, well, actually from Let It Be on, when they were still an indie band, they had all that variety. They always had it going on. No, actually, no, correction, going back to Hootenanny. There's that much variety in Hootenanny. So actually, I think they only really had one complete straightforward punk rock album, quote unquote, with Sorry Ma. Yeah. And then everything after that showed such a wide a range of songwriting and ability. So yes, I stand corrected. So they've always had it going on. And
you can kind of see Paul's confidence as a songwriter emerging through all that music, you know, like as he gets more comfortable with these, you know, he doesn't have to just wail out and, like, you know, play as loud and as fast as possible. He can actually, you know, slow down those tempos and experiment with other ideas. I think that was an interesting thing to kind of trace over the course of the albums leading up to this album.
For a guy who's so, you know, tortured by his own demons and tortured by alcoholism, and to find such beauty in the world and get it down on pen and paper and write such beautiful guitar parts, it's a shame that we don't see more of him these days. You know, all his solo stuff, all the grandpa boy stuff, you know, it's just, we need you. We need more of you, Paul. If you're listening, just come out of hiding, man. We love you so much.
All right, Adam, are you ready to dive into these songs?
Let's do it.
All right. So the album starts off with Hold My Life. A great opener where songwriter Paul Westerberg looks at the moments of irresponsibility in his life. And, you know, the song just starts right in. I love how there's no, like, intro or, like, you know, there's nothing going on. It's just like, let's go, you know?
And we're off. And we're off to the races. And yeah, Hold My Life is an amazing opener. And to think, so we're sequencing this thing. What are we going to have as the opening song? Oh, I know. Let's have a song that I wrote 2 weeks before I went in to record the album.
And all it's I just, had was the chorus. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it actually started completely instrumental. It's just a jam. And then there was just a chorus. And then it just kind of filled out. I mean, what an amazing start to the album. I just, my main takeaway is, holy shit, the power, the production, the lyrics, rereading the book, realizing, wow, this was a product from just weeks, you know, prior to going in the studio. Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing starts.
Yeah. The song uses those big open chords for the great chorus, you know, really kind of like amplifies it and then pulls it in really tight for the, I Just Might Lose It. And I just love that contrast between those big open chords and the palm muted guitar.
And, you know, just being so blessed as to, you know, see that song live, see any of these songs live, see any Replacement songs from their discography whatsoever. Amazing. But I don't think I went quite as batshit crazy as when they played songs from this record, especially Hold My Life.
I just think it's so funny that he had this chorus. And, like, you know, I'm sure you've written songs. How often have you come up with just a great chorus, like something that really works? And then you're like, what the hell am I going to attach to this? You know, like, what, where do I go now? This is so good. You know,
I don't know if I enjoyed writing songs. It means that I would be able to get past that, but it's difficult. My bar is way too high. When my bar is, you know, Paul Westerberg standard.
There is a reference to the Tudor Turtle cartoon from the 1960s in this song. Tudor's friend, Mr. Wizard's many catchphrases on the show were things like drizzle, drazzle, drizzle, drome, time for this one to come home. And so Paul uses this and it's like, why? Wait, where did he get this? You know, it's echoed in the phrase from his song, razzle, dazzle, drazzle, drone, time for this one to come home. So I always thought that was kind of an interesting thing. You know, we were talking about how he wrote the song right before going into the studio. He maybe just heard it and was like, yep, I'm using that.
Wow, Mr. Wizard?
Not Mr. Wizard, the Mr. Wizard you and I know from the 80s, the old fart that did all the science experiments. I'm talking about like the 1960s. It was like a wacky cartoon or something.
Oh, well, he was an old guy in the 80s. For all I knew, Mr. Wizard was you know, already a show in the 60s. Mm. Yeah, all right. I didn't know that. That's pretty cool. I'm going to have to look up that cartoon.
Yeah. All right, Adam, let's move on to I'll Buy. A 50s rock-inspired tune, something out of like Chuck Berry or something. It's kind of, you know, it's got a good groove. Parts of it kind of sound like the Rolling Stones a little bit.
Yeah, I'll Buy, you know, there's one, I don't know chord, I don't read music or anything like that, but there's like a seventh chord in there or something, and it kind of gives it like a Broadway vibe. Yeah. I mean, you have to put it on and listen to it, but it's pretty, it works. Again, it's like every single song on this record is a classic. All the lyrics are incredible.
Yeah, I love the lyrics in this one. He's talking about, you know, buying things with money, but also buying into what his gal is saying. You know, anything you say, dear, I'll buy it. You know, I'll buy into this. I'll buy. And I always thought that was kind of a cool way that he kind of plays with the word buy and uses it in these two different directions.
That's pretty cool, because whenever I listen to that song, I always think about, you know, buying someone a beer.
Mm.
You know, I'll get your drink.
Yeah.
Different interpretation, I suppose.
And that's what I love about music, man. Everybody can have sort of a different takeaway. There's a song later on in the album. It'll be interesting to hear your take on it. I have an odd take on it, so we'll get to that one. But
okay.
One of the things I really like about this song, there's something I really like about this song, and then there's something I don't like about the song. So I love the key change in the middle. I think that's awesome. I love how they just whoop. Change up.
I love a good key change.
Yep.
Love it.
One thing I am not wild about, and every time it comes on, I kind of cringe a little bit, is the use of the word retard in the song. That always kind of bothers me. You know, it's cringy. I wish it wasn't there. You know, people tend to argue, it was the 80s, man. But whatever. It's an insensitive phrase. It's not, shouldn't be there, you know.
I didn't even think I picked up on it, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, but he's talking about the movies. Yep.
Oh, well, you know, right.
The album never came with a lyric sheet. When people bought the record, there was no lyric sheet. So,
right. There's no lyric sheet with this one. So, you know, I think it's one of those records where I sing a lot of incorrect lyrics. I mean, I sing a lot of incorrect lyrics with records that do come with lyric sheets. I just didn't feel it. There's open to interpretation, and then there's lyrics that are, I guess, open to interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, one thing, it kind of redeems itself at the end, though, because I love how the song ends and you just hear like a honk of some sort. Have you ever noticed that?
Honk.
The last chord.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, you're the first person that I heard mention that honk. I thought it was just me. I don't know. It's like one of those bicycle horns.
Yeah. All right. So I'm not hearing things. You're not hearing things. There's definitely a honk.
No, it's on there. Okay, good. I'm not completely out of my head.
Nice. All right, let's move on to Kiss Me on the Bus.
Well, I don't know if this intentionally was going for a big star sound, but the version that made the record really does have that shine. It has like this like pixie dust attached to it that makes it. And by, you know, I'm just, every time I think about this song now, I think about their second performance at SNL shortly after Lorne Michaels bans them from the show, which didn't really hold, did it? Because Paul ended up coming back and playing it as a solo artist in 93, I think, when eventually came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, you know, rereading that, and it's such a beautiful song. It's such a sweet song, this slice of life. I'm just picturing, you know, kids on the way to school, you know, it's a beautiful story. It's this little vignette, isn't it?
Yeah. Of, yeah, definitely.
Two young kids. I mean, that's the way that I interpret it.
Just like a little moment. But, yeah. You catch someone that you don't know, like on the bus or somewhere. And it's just like that moment where you're like, oh, you know, like, I love this person, but like, you know, like you don't know them. They don't know you. And he's just pouring
his unrequited love, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Pouring his heart out to this stranger. Most people get on the bus and kind of just keep to themselves, you know, stare at their phone. Well, this is, you know, the 80s, stare at a newspaper and, you know, busy themselves so they don't have to make small talk. You know, how often have you just like, don't talk to me, don't talk to me, you know, you stuck your nose in your phone and, you know, yeah. And this one, he's kind of noticing someone. He sings, "Ooh, if you knew how I felt now, you wouldn't act so adult now. Hurry, hurry, here comes my stop." And it's just funny. He's thinking about like, he wants to make a scene, you know, but can't stand the rejection. It's just a fun song. I grew to like this one. I didn't like this one the first time I heard it.
No?
No. So here's why. I was a teenager. This was the 90s. I was a knuckleheaded teenager. I will openly admit.
You too?
Yeah. My first few times listening to Tim, I thought it sounded kind of like a sing-along. Like you know that like every kindergarten teacher like heard the song and was like, oh, like I can sing about the farm, you know, we're gonna grow some corn on the farm, we're gonna milk the cows on the farm.
You know what you're saying?
It's like,
please don't make me hate the song.
No, I'm sorry, but so this is my knuckleheaded teenager self being like, oh, come on, you know. So I just used to laugh about that, but it is a great song. And you know, as I listen to it more and more and more, you know, and dig into like the sweet, you know, message behind it and realize what a great alternative pop song it is, you know, I really grew to love it. So, but I had to bring that story up because it's just a classic case of like just being a dumb kid, but then like, appreciating the music, you know?
Well, you know, it's a very romantic song. And I have the tendency personally to romanticize things. And it took me until talking about it right now with you, my man, where I'm making a direct correlation between this song and the first song on the first Green Day record at the library.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't believe that Billy, being such a huge Replacements fanatic,
he's a huge fan.
Years later, would end up playing a bunch of festival dates with the band. I can't help but think how inspired he was to write the song at the library based upon this song.
Absolutely. That's a really good connection.
I definitely see a correlation there. I feel like it's the same exact song about unrequited love, and I just think it's terrific.
Yeah, absolutely. One more thing about this song before we move on. There's a little bit of a debate going on in the internet world about who actually plays the guitar solo. So supposedly the guitar solo was done by Tommy Ramone. Tommy was no stranger to playing lead guitar, as he had split lead guitar duties with Ed Stasium on the first four Ramones records. But I've also read interviews where Paul has claimed he played the solo and Stinson didn't show up. So, you know, investigating the matter, I think most fans believe that it was Paul and that Tommy like mistakenly thinks it was him. Maybe he did a version and they didn't use it, but it's so funny that there's this debate going on. Who played the solo? It wasn't Bob.
I didn't know Tommy and Ramone to, you know, be anything of a lead player. And it's not, it's a lead better than what I know how to play. That's for sure. I'm willing to wager that it was Paul.
The next song on the album is Dose of Thunder. This is an interesting track because to me, it seems a bit out of place on the record. You know, you have these great like pop rock songs and then you get to this one and it's like loud. It's like a harder driven song. He's like pounding on B flat and shouting. And there's even like some metal inspired guitar work throughout. It's been pretty well documented that this song was only recorded. It's been pretty well documented that this song was only recorded in order to give guitarist Bob Stinson something to play over. He liked to rock out and enjoyed the creativity of playing something new all the time, so they knew each night, like no solo was ever the same. And so I tend to go along with that. It's like, okay, I can see how this song was probably put on there, like, you know, to appease Bob. Hey, Bob, here's something you can kind of wail over.
I know Bob tried to put a guitar lick on Swingin' Party, but it wasn't really that kind of song. Mm. And so this one was definitely right up his alley, definitely something that's worthy of, you know, every great dive rock bar. Why did I say dive rock bar? That's not a thing. Worthy of every dive bar. But yeah, I mean, this one was really influenced by Slade. Mm. And I never really thought about it in those terms. And then, you know, after rereading Trouble Boys, I'm like, oh, yeah, I can see that. I'm a big Slade fan, but I never computed that there was anything influenced by the band Slade on here. Mm-hmm. This would be one. And I always resorted this to a song strictly about cocaine. Maybe I'm off base.
Oh, definitely.
It was the mid-80s, and everyone was doing it.
It only takes a little till you want a ton.
Give me one good dose of thunder. Yep. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense to me. I mean, that's definitely the most raucous song on the album. Mm-hmm. And I can understand what you're saying about how it doesn't fit completely. You know, Replacements records are known for having, you know, a lot of variety, but I think the songs can be categorized as, you know, these great rock and roll anthems, Left of the Dial, Bastards of Young are definitely songs that I would consider to be, you know, anthems. And then you have, you know, Swingin' Party, Here Comes a Regular, which is just, it's like, it's haunting, absolutely beautiful. It's one of Paul's best compositions ever. And it's also one of his softest compositions ever. Yeah, song in particular, Dose of Thunder, it's not in either of those categories, is it? It's something different.
Yeah.
And it's still a great song. I can see where you're going there, that it doesn't fit as well as the other songs.
Yeah. I'm waiting for someone to do like the Tim remix and remaster where they just strip all the reverb off of it, and then then maybe it won't be so bad. I don't know.
I was really down on 80s stuff for a really long time, and that was the reason.
Reverb.
Because of the reverb. I'm not into reverb. I don't like it. I think there's a lot of like overuse of drum reverb in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not into it. And hearing those remixes, you know, from the Warner Brothers records, I agree with you there.
Nice. All right, the next song is Waitress in the Sky. This is a country-sounding tune inspired by the horror stories that Paul's sister Julie told him about being a flight attendant. This is Westerberg's tongue-in-cheek impression of the misogynistic men his sister would serve. In the song, he's taking on the role of these guys, you know, these passengers, singing, "Don't treat me special or don't kiss my ass. Treat me like the way they treat him up in first class." And, you know, it's a great little tune, funny lyrics, and sounds a little bit like Mountain of Love. It's
yeah, it's definitely the lightest fare on the record. And they always have to, you know, tote out one song, you know, with a lot of humor. And you have to understand where, you know, they're coming from. When you're listening to it, I'm sure a lot of people listened to it and didn't see any sense of irony in it whatsoever.
Yeah, these guys are pissed.
Because, you know, when you're a touring international musician and you're in air constantly, you know, it could have very well have been autobiographical. I guess it was a wink and a nod to Paul's sister Julie. And yeah, Billy Joe Armstrong comes up again because he, you know, grabbed some of these lyrics and reused them on Warning. And sanitation expert and maintenance engineer.
And that's my favorite line of the whole song. So I remember hearing that on Warning and being like, oh, like, hey, I know that.
The song Warning on the album, Warning, yes.
Yeah. Sanitation expert and a maintenance engineer, garbage man, a janitor, and you, my dear. It's like, you know, a flight attendant does all these jobs on a plane. It's just great, great lyrics, great imagery. One of my favorite live albums is the, I don't know if you've ever heard of a band called the Ziggins. They have a live album called Tickets Still Available, and they have a song called There's Something About a Waitress. And at one point, they pay homage to this song by yelling, "You ain't nothing but a waitress in the sky." And like, warning, when I heard that, I was like, oh, I love like when people like will do that. We'll like borrow a little lyrical part and like throw it into a song. It's like candy for us music nerds that like, you know, love this stuff.
Little Easter eggs. I love that.
Yeah. It's fun when bands
do that. Very cool.
All right, the next track on the album is Swingin' Party. I really like this song a lot. It's an emotional song spelling out Westerberg's fears and regrets over spending his youth intoxicated, stating, "If being afraid is a crime, we'll hang side by side at the swinging party down the line."
I mean, he was very forthright about his experiences in life. And I think that's what makes him such a great artist, because he is not afraid to bear everything. Paul Westerberg is not afraid to bear his soul. And he does so on this. He does so later on. On Here Comes a Regular, which is not completely autobiographical, so he claims, but it's at least a little bit autobiographical.
Sure.
And, you know, I think this up with, you know, Here Comes a Regular are, you know, two of the most beautiful moments in their entire career. And
I agree.
I just love that vulnerability.
Yeah. And can you imagine bearing your soul like that?
I cannot.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Not, I mean, if it's not, you know, my therapist, then.
Right.
Not so much.
Not on your major label debut.
No, I don't know. But, you know, that's, I think that's the sign of a true artist, that you're, you know, unencumbered and you're free to, you know.
Yeah.
To show every bit of you.
Mm-hmm. So, Adam, this is the song that I want to get your interpretations of, because for the longest time, I thought the song was just about like a drunken party, but I had heard at some point, and I don't know if someone was just feeding me bullshit, but I heard that a swinging party is actually a phrase used to describe when someone hangs themselves.
this
might be pretty morbid, but
I mean, that's how I interpreted it. Anytime I just read that song title on the back of the jacket, I picture a noose with a body dangling. Paul Westerberg is incredible.
Yeah.
And you can list many different ways. And I did interpret it about suicide, and he would later write about suicide in The Ledge, which was actually released as a single.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a little bit more direct in that specific song. But yeah.
All right. So we agree on that.
Yeah, I agree with that. He has never been afraid to shy away from really difficult subject matters like alcoholism and suicide, and that's why he's the best.
Yeah, it's just such a well-written song. It creates this hopeless feeling, like he's stuck and he can't get out. I love the line, "If being wrong's a crime, I'm serving forever." It's just like, damn.
But you know, it's empowering to listen to that, because you know, it's a cliche, but cliches are cliches for a reason, and you know, you're not in this alone.
Right.
He sees you. He hears you. You've been there. There's no doubt that his writing has saved many lives
because
of songs like this.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And as a bass player, I'm sure you can appreciate the bass runs in this song. I think this song's got a lot of really great bass work in it.
All over the whole record. And, you know, I was listening to it just before we got together, and it doesn't matter how many times I've listened to it, I'm picking up amazing bass work from Tommy that I never even heard. I don't know what the hell I was doing all these years. Was I just listening to the car? I don't know. But
lyrics, yeah.
And it's the same record, and I've listened to this record, I don't know, at least like actually 200 times in my life.
Yeah.
That many times. So crazy. Crazy to pick up on new things so many years later.
It's fun.
Hey everyone, I just wanted to take a minute to direct your attention towards our Instagram at Talking Records Podcast.
We can also be found on Twitter and YouTube. Give us a like or a follow and join in the chatter about favorite records and songs. We're music lovers and collectors and love nothing more than to chat music. Come say hello. You can also visit our website at talkingrecordspodcast.com. There you will find episodes, merch, and more. You can even drop us an email at talkingrecords@outlook.com. These are all great ways for us to connect with you over all the great music we enjoy. We would love to get this podcast into more ears, and you can help by providing us with a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as every review helps us reach more listeners. Also, word of mouth is helpful too. All right, thanks everyone. All right, the next song is Bastards of Young. A song about generational divide. Great song.
Amazing song. I mean, very anthemic, isn't it? I mean, it got me hooked, and I was 2, 3.
Yeah.
I don't know. and to have such an anthemic song, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, with the advent of YouTube, every music video ever is available. But I'm not so sure how many people have seen the music video to this, and it's just like the anti-music video.
Yeah.
And it was so cool.
They realized they didn't have to be in it, so they're like, all right.
Yeah, I mean, this song is covered a ton. This song, Little Mascara, Left of the Dial, they all start with these two-bar guitar intros. Mm. And apparently, Paul was kind of going for an early Who kind of sound.
Sure, yeah, I hear that.
It's a Generation X anthem. I've always interpreted this song as, so you're out of school, you're going into the working world, you're faced with all these real world, you know, problems. Mm-hmm. Are you going to, you know, fall into the, you know, shoes of previous generations? Or are you going to model your life after your parents? Or mm-hmm. are you going to, mm-hmm. you know, go against the grain? Are you going to make your own way? And, you know, just kind of one of those rallying songs, like, you know, carve your own path, or
yeah, absolutely.
Trying to say, and I don't know. It's like it's a battle cry, isn't it?
Yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah, it sounds. You were just talking about cliches. It sounds like cliche to say it's the song, you know, the voice of a generation. But it's just such a great song. It's such a well-written song, and it's got that big chorus, and you know, he's got that line, "Wait on the sons of no one," which is actually from the Bible, I guess. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's singing, the ones who love us least are the ones we'll die to please. And I'm like, man, that is so dead on. I mean, think about today when people are working so hard on social media to get everyone's attention, you know, the 5 seconds of attention, trying to build up followers and likes and all that stuff. And it's like,
yeah, the whole Andy Warhol thing, man. 15 seconds of fame, 15 minutes of fame. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, you can interpret that to be friends, you can interpret it to be family. Mm-hmm. I think one thing's for certain, and I don't feel like it's even up for debate. The whole spirit of the song is fuck it all.
Yeah.
Get out of my way.
Yep.
I'm going to carve my own path.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
Fuck it all. So is this where we talk about Saturday Night Live?
Oh, yeah.
I think so. Yeah,
they were stuck on what, the 13th floor? Is that where? Studio 8H's SNL.
Yeah.
They were stuck up there, and they didn't realize they couldn't leave all day from, you know, sound check through dress rehearsals and then the final live taping. They were just getting drunk.
They just drank and drank.
And they invited the host in, Harry Dean Stanton, yeah. was hosting, and he came in, and I think Sam Kinison was on the show that night, wow. if I'm not mistaken. He's trouble. I remember reading they were going through blocking, you know, finding out, you know, what cameras are going to be on them and when and where to stand and what levels their amp should be at. And then right when they finished dress rehearsal, they turned up the amps. Yeah. So the folks at home got all that static, yeah. just like being at a replacement show. Mm-hmm. And what they feasted their eyes on, it was a band that didn't really give a damn about blocking, didn't care that they were on live television, and acted like they were just playing in a dive bar.
Yeah.
Paul dropping the F-bomb.
Yeah.
Which is why they were banned.
So I guess the story is that when they did their rehearsal, they were great. Like, they had a buzz on, they were loose, and they played great. And yeah, you're right, then they gave the volumes a spin. But Bob Stinson had missed his cue. He had missed his solo cue. And so when they're actually playing the song for the show, Paul steps back from the mic and yells, "Come on, fucker!" on live TV. All downhill from there, I guess. I don't know.
And then that wink, that, you know, vaudevillian wink that he gives after that portion of the song was actually to Al Franken, who was standing off camera, another Twin Cities native, then producer of SNL, standing there with a clipboard, whose face just started to frown very slowly after that F-bomb. It's a shame. I feel Al Franken was and probably is to this day a big Replacements fan, and they dirty dogged him. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I guess G.E. Smith was also a huge fan of the band.
I mean, how can you not be, right? Yeah. G.E. Smith, how cool is that? Guy had to have had impeccable taste. He married Gilda, so there you go.
So the band was against doing videos for MTV, but their management said, well, look, we can get you a live TV appearance, and if we do that, you got to make a video, right? So the Pointer Sisters drop off SNL. The Replacements are brought in the last minute. You know, the whole drunken debacle takes place. They come back for a second song. They do Kiss Me on the Bus, where they're all wearing like each other's clothes.
Oh, yeah. Bob wasn't aware at the time, so he didn't switch because he stepped away for a moment, probably to get high.
I heard Bob broke his guitar. Like, he had to borrow one of G.E. Smith's guitars.
You know, yeah, I think I can't recall if he was playing a different guitar, but I think, was he playing a Les Paul for Bastards, and then maybe it was something else?
I think so.
I know for sure Tommy was playing a Rickenbacker as he played on the Tim record, and it's a shame because it didn't have that much low end. And
yeah,
I think the whole band, they were kind of disappointed with the production, how everything came out. I think in retrospect, Tommy Stinson wished that he had played, you know, a P bass or something with more low end. But
yeah,
I only mention that because he was faithful to Rickenbacker's that whole period of his career. And you can see that Tommy was playing one on SNL.
Yeah. Well, critics have complained that the record sounds thin compared to the band's previous album, the indie record. The drums are farther back in the mix, and most complain that, yeah, their major label debut just kind of sounds a little thin, a little light. I guess, according to Tommy Erday, or Tommy Ramone, in Tape Op, he said, the drums are not that loud when one compares them to other rock albums of that era. As a matter of fact, I was careful not to join the crowd with that explosive Phil Collins sound that everyone else was using at the time. I did not want the record to sound dated in the future. I like having the drums well balanced, as I do everything else. We recorded and mixed the whole project on a Neotech console. It did not have enough channels to mix with, so we had to add on a small Soundcraft board as an extension to put the effects through. So just kind of some interesting background information about the sound of the record, but yeah.
I think it's great. I mean, I shied away from, you know, any 80s recordings for a long time, but I kind of gave in because the 80s actually ended up having a ton of great music.
Yeah.
You want to listen to it, you have to listen to the production.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to Lay It Down, Clown. So I'll go ahead and say it. This is probably my least favorite song on the album.
Agreed.
Yeah, this is a throwaway. I mean, what are they even singing about? Yeah. Peter Buck from REM, I've heard.
Yeah. Peter Buck has a history with the Replacements because he played guitar in I Will Dare, didn't he? The opening track to Let It Be.
Yep.
So they go back a ways, the REM camp and the Replacements camp.
So this one just, to me, feels like an inside joke, you know? It's like they're teasing him about his, like, speed addiction or something.
I mean, I just want to be clear. I think every song on this album rules.
Yeah.
But this rules, I think, just slightly less than every single other
comparatively,
song.
Comparatively, it's just not as good. you can't put this one up against like Hold My Life or, you know, Left of the Dial. It's just like, you know.
No, you can't. No, I don't really have a whole lot to say about this specific song.
No, I don't either. All right, let's move on to Left of the Dial. Now, this is a great song.
Ooh, yeah.
This is a great song. A sweet song about listening to a love interest's band being played on college radio. I guess the song actually grew out of Paul's friendship with Let's Active guitarist Lynn Blakey and hearing her voice on a college radio station as they were kind of traveling through the night, like maybe after a show or something.
It's known as a quote-unquote hidden love song.
Mm-hmm.
I just think this is maybe one of the greatest rock and roll songs ever. And my favorite, I mean, actually, oh man, so many of these lyrics are good, but little girl keeps growing up, playing makeup, wearing guitar.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's really fucking cool.
Yeah.
First time that I saw Paul and Tommy back together on stage for the first time in 2014, I especially flipped out for this song. Flew all the way to Chicago to see them.
Wow.
At Riot Fest. Didn't watch any other bands. Really, I mean, incidentally, I saw some bands. I saw Bob Mould. This was worth the trip just to hear them play Left of the Dial.
Great.
I don't know. You can't get more anthemic than this.
Love that line. I love weary voice that's laughing on the radio once. We sounded drunk, never made it on. Passing through and it's late. The station started to fade. Picked another one up in the next town or the very next state. Yeah, it's just, you know, an ode to college radio. And I guess, you know, the Replacements were heavily supported on college radio. So it's kind of like a little bit of a nod, you know, to that.
Yeah, on the surface, it's, you know, the love of college radio and all things independent rock and roll has to offer. Mm-hmm. And then on another deeper level, it's, as you said, yeah, he was trying to tune in to, you know, his beau at the time, Lynn Blakey. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, they were on tour, station started to fade, picked another one up in the very next state. We've all been there. Even I myself have listened to terrestrial radio at one point in my life, and that's how it was. Kids today will never know the struggle of losing that signal, having to drive a little bit further.
Turning the knob just a little bit to see if, like, oh, maybe if I just turn it a little bit, one click this way, will it be stronger? Will the signal be stronger?
We were resorted to banging on the damn boom box, and sometimes that worked, giving them a little, little nudge, like pawns.
Oh, man. All right. Great song. Let's move on to A Little Mascara.
Another one with the Who intro.
Yeah. Yeah, and this one's pretty straightforward. And I definitely pick up a lot of Who on this one. I pick up a little Bruce Springsteen on this one.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, a song about a single mother whose husband left her and the children alone. The lyrics describe the loneliness and frustration the woman feels regarding her struggles to make ends meet. He sings, all you ever wanted was someone to take care of you. All you're ever losing is a little mascara. It's like, it's just going to make you cry. You know, all that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's another song. I mean, there's this one, Left of the Dial, Kiss Me on the Boss, and there are these little vignettes. There are these little mini movies.
Yeah.
He paints a very specific, just a vivid picture in this one. It's a true talent to be able to do that in, what, 2 minutes, 3 minutes?
Yeah, a short little pop song.
If they made a music video for this, I'm sure it would have been of a toilet, just sitting there. I don't know.
Just a single shot of a toilet.
Yeah, I don't know. It would have been something hilarious, and it would have deflated the whole meaning of the song. That's the Replacements. They do shit like that.
But isn't that amazing, though, that they wrote it's amazing music, but then like just did nothing to sort of promote it. Like they didn't make flashy videos. They didn't do any of that stuff. They really, I think, believed enough in this stuff that it spoke for itself.
I agree. No true artists. That was their artistic statement. And I think when I was a bit younger, I scoffed at that expression. I didn't really know what that meant. I understand it now. I think it takes a true artist to be able to do that and say, you know, this is my art, and I don't want to make a video, but I'm very reluctant to do that. The dump truck of money was dropped off at my door. I guess I have to promote this thing. Have at it and do whatever you want, but the songs stand up for themselves, and we don't care what pictures are playing on TV. Even when the picture was of them playing that, nothing else, they were still fucking with authority, still fucking with NBC and all the sponsors. You know, they couldn't do that. They couldn't just perform in this nice, neat little box with their blocking and being in just the right place. And, you know, the director being in lockstep with them, they couldn't even do that, because that too was a part of their art. Mm-hmm. And does it sound dorky? Yeah. I mean, I feel dorky when I say that, but I think it's absolutely true.
Yeah, I agree with you. The album closes with "Here Comes a Regular."
Here comes a regular. Call out your name.
What a song. Oh, man, what a song.
Heartbreak.
So depressing, yeah. Oh, this one just tugs at my heartstrings.
But I can't skip it.
No, oh no.
I have to do it every time.
Absolutely.
It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. I mean, it's so sad. Person must work up a deep, deep thirst after a hard day of nothing much at all. I mean, it's a song about unemployment. It's a song about alcoholism. It's a song about the sadness of going to the bar where, quote unquote, everybody knows your name.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the darkness in life, the hopelessness. And again, it goes back to the sheer artistry and Paul's ability to connect with folks on a really deep and profound level. And it's kind of soul crushing in a very beautiful way.
Yeah. Paul sings "Kneeling Alongside Old Sad Eyes." He says, "Opportunity knocks once, then the door slams shut. All I know is I'm sick of everything that my money can buy. The fool who wastes his life, God rest his guts."
Man,
it's just a simple but powerful song. You know, it's just the 12-string guitar. There's a piano that comes in later. And yeah, like you said, it's just about drinking your life away, missing opportunities, feeling down and out and dependent on this, you know, one place, where even there, you're not in control. You know, you've got this addiction. You've got this thing that you can't drop. You can't fight it. It's just taken over.
Yeah. To paraphrase a fan that I saw in Paul Westerberg, he put out a solo documentary in the early 2000s when he did an acoustic tour, which came to Pearl Street, by the way, and Somerville. So I went to a couple of those. And one of the fans who hadn't seen him since the Replacements broke up said, and I'm paraphrasing, he's like, "It was the Replacements. It was the perfect soundtrack when I was drinking, and now I'm sober, and it's just the most perfect music now that I'm sober." That's heavy.
Yeah, that's real heavy.
To come back from the darkness and to just be, I can't even try to explain it, but I think he explained it the best, yeah. That gentleman.
All right. So Adam, let's take a quick look at the cover art for Tim. The art was done by Robert Longo. And from that Bob Muir book, Trouble Boys, he writes, "Longo conjured a strange mixed media tableau for Tim's cover. The bottom portion depicted the foreboding corridor of an Orwellian building that seemed to stand in for the music business. The top section featured a series of charcoal drawings of the band members, based on Longo's photos of them. Mars and Westerberg appear to be blinded by some overpowering light. Tommy stands with his back turned, head bowed. The three of them are dominated by the giant upside-down image of Bob Stinson's face, inspired by a shot of Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now, which registers as an ominous peering force all bathed in hot pink."
Yeah. You know, I'm looking at this and I never even, because he was upside down, I never realized exactly how prominent Bob's caricature is on the cover. I was just so distracted by the bottom, much bleaker portion with the Orwellian corridor. And I stared at this for so long, for so many years. It's just kind of funny that I never really spent a whole lot of time turning it upside down. I was just boggled. I just never quite understood it.
Yeah.
What's going on here? Didn't really match the artwork at all. I mean, it didn't match the music at all.
No. It's such a strange color.
I was just kind of baffled. Yeah.
Strange and like foreboding. Like, it almost seems to like foreshadow. I mean, they must have known that Bob was on the way out, but just to put him so prominently up there, you know, it's about Bob, you know. He was like this presence, you know, maybe holding the band back, holding the band down. And I don't know. It's like, what are they trying to say here? But it's an interesting cover.
I don't know. Apparently, Paul Westerberg, Tommy Stinson were just happy to let Bob go and gallivant around in his sorrow and move forward, because I feel like they felt like Bob was holding them back. And Paul knew that he couldn't get far without Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy knew that he couldn't get as far without Paul. And Chris Mars is a just fucking amazing drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he really ever got his due as one. But my God, he's an amazing player. And yeah, it's kind of interesting that they had Bob so prominently on here when he definitely played the least.
Yeah, he's barely on there.
It was always intriguing, wasn't it? I mean, this cover, the other covers were pretty straightforward, but the back is more, well, that looks like a cover. It's just them playing live with the credits, but the front, yeah, it always puzzled me. Very cryptic.
Very cryptic. Concerning the album title, Tim, manager Peter Jesperson told a Minneapolis radio station, "I clearly remember Paul Westerberg saying one day, I think we should call the album Tim. I said, why? And he said, because it's such a nice name." And that's all there is to it. No deep meaning, no cryptic message, no, you know, it's just, let's call the fucking thing Tim. In closing, this album and the band's previous one, Let It Be, tend to be the replacements albums people know best. A time where the musical direction was starting to split, and not quite everyone was on board. This album, the band, has such an interesting backstory. And understanding what the band was going through really puts the album into perspective for me. Paul Westerberg was someone who wanted to become famous, but didn't quite feel comfortable achieving it. Paul Stinson wanted out. A band who seemed to do everything in their power to self-sabotage themselves, antagonizing crowds, drinking too much, making odd decisions for their live sets. But strong songwriting is strong songwriting, and these songs have pushed themselves past all of that, helping the Replacements to become one of the most influential alternative rock bands of all time. Countless bands will cite the Mats as a major influence. As a huge fan of alternative rock myself in the 90s, I had to check out this band. Tim has been a longtime favorite and an album I revisit all the time.
God damn it, thank you for letting me talk about my favorite Replacements album. It means a lot to me. The Replacements are one of the first bands that I ever truly loved. I mean, I was in goddamn diapers at the time, I think. And pleasure to be on. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Listen to Tim.
Yeah.
Again. And then again. And then again. And then again.
And then four more times. And try to figure out that album cover.
Yeah.
Adam, it is always a pleasure to talk music with you, man. You've got a lot of insights, and I've always enjoyed talking music with you. So when I asked you to come back on the show and you sent me your list of albums, I was so excited to see Tim on there. I wasn't expecting it. And I was like, we have to do that record. So thank you so much for suggesting it. Thanks for coming on the podcast today and going through it with me. This was a lot of fun.
All my love to you, my man. Be well. Can't wait for the next one.
Nice. I would like to thank Tape Op. I'd like to thank Bob Muir and his great book, Trouble Boys. I'd like to thank the countless message boards and YouTube videos I checked out to gather information about this record. I'd like to thank my man Craig for putting a CD in the microwave when we were teens to see what would happen. I'd like to thank Krista Makes from Less Than Jake for the theme music. And of course, thank you so much to all of you for listening to this podcast. It's a labor of love and an opportunity to connect with people over great music. We hope you'll join the chatter on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and our website, talkingrecordspodcast.com. Until next time, don't judge an album by its crappy title, I guess. All right, Adam, be well, my man.
Be well. My voice already cracked the first thing I said. I said, hey, Jed.
Hi.
Hi. It's that 40, it's that new 40-year-old puberty.
Yeah. Yeah.